Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast.
Did you know that LSD is being tested as a treatment for alcoholism, or that psilocybin is being taken to ease the anxiety of late-stage cancer patients in government-sanctioned studies? Psychedelic substances have been used for ceremony and as medicine for millennia, and such properties were being cultivated and studied in the U.S. in the 60s and early 70s. Until widespread and careless use of psychedelics and sensational media reports produced a backlash. Now, over the last several years and under the radar, such use and study has begun again. In the first half of this hour, I'm going to talk with Charles Grobe, MD, about the latest scientific research, including his own groundbreaking studies. And then in the second half, I'll be joined by James Fadiman to discuss the ideas, the vision, and the advice in his new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. Charles Grobe, MD, is director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, and professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine. He conducted the first government-approved psychobiological research study of MDMA, also known as ecstasy. And he was the principal investigator on a research project in the Amazon studying the visionary plant brew ayahuasca. He investigated the efficacy of psilocybin to treat anxiety in terminally ill patients. A founding board member of the Hefter Research Institute, that institute which is devoted to fostering research on psychedelic, Grobe is the editor of Hallucinogens, a Reader, and co-editor with Roger Walsh of Higher Wisdom, Eminent Elders Explore the Continuing Impact of Psychedelics. Welcome again, Charles Grobe.
It's good to be here, Terrence.
You know, I was in doing research for this. I go online, I'm looking at articles and so on, and I find this article, and it was from our interview in 2006 on Alternet, which I hadn't even realized had been made into an article. So that was fun. Sort of, oh, that's us. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So could you briefly talk about your path to the work you're doing today? To many, child and adolescent psychiatry and psychedelic research would seem two different worlds. How have those two paths come together for you?
Well, I'd say that my interest with psychedelics, particularly the potential medical application of psychedelics, really dates back to the early 1970s when I had an opportunity to look and read some of the literature up to that point in the psychiatric and medical and neuroscience literature, and I found it absolutely fascinating, and I found that this was an area that held great promise. And while there was also a sense that research was slowing down, I thought it would be a great area to go into. So I went back to school, did all my pre-med, medical school. However, by the time I left medical school in 1979, all research in its entirety, the United States had been shut down. And in fact, it was about 2.5 decades before anything was able to get back on track again. But I went through first my training in medicine, then training in psychiatry, and I felt drawn to child psychiatry as well. I felt working with young people, there was a great opportunity to have an impact on the course of their lives. I thought it was a great way to understand even adult pathology, understanding how that forms in early childhood. So it was an area that was a good fit for me. I went into it. I stayed in an academic setting, and now I've been at Harbor UCLA for almost 20 years. I've run the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Division there. And given that I'm in academic medicine, it's expected to some degree to carve out a niche area of expertise and to even develop research. And for me, it just turned out that opportunities arose to develop research studies with MDMA, with ayahuasca, and most recently with psilocybin. We had permission from the U.S. Regulatory agencies and state regulators and our local hospital, IRB and Research Committee, to conduct a placebo-controlled double-blind study looking at safety and efficacy of the use of psilocybin, which is the active alkaloid first identified in hallucinogenic mushrooms, We had permission to develop a treatment model with individuals with advanced stage cancer who had overwhelming anxiety, they were in severe existential crisis. And on the basis of early research conducted going back to the late 50s with Eric Cast in Chicago and later Walt Pankey and Stan Groff and Bill Richards at Maryland, it appeared that there was a very viable model that held great promise. Unfortunately, it had been cut off way too short back in the 60s because of political and cultural turmoil, but we felt that it would be a good opportunity to go back to this early research model, update it to accord with state-of-the-art contemporary research methodologies, but we felt the time was finally right to resume work that had been prematurely put down some decades earlier.
Okay. I wanted to set just a little bit of historical context for the whole hour, and to go back a little further than you did. I mentioned in the intro that humans have ingested psychedelic substances, although they probably didn't call them that. Although I see that psychedelic, the Greek meaning, mm-hmm. is very true about what they seem to do. It's the
mind manifesting.
Yeah.
Mind revealing.
Mind revealing.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And actually the term hallucinogen, which gets a bad rap sometime, if you go back to its etymological roots, I believe in the Latin, you see that it means mind wandering or mind journeying.
Expanding, perhaps.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So Aldous Huxley contended that all plant hallucinogens, without exception, have been known and systematically used by human beings from time immemorial. Mm-hmm. Now, when did they emerge in modern society?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right that indigenous prehistorical societies often made use of the local psychoactive plants. They were utilized in their ritual for healing, for divination, for a variety of purposes. But the modern hallucinogen era, well, I think there are two places you can look. One would be in the late 1890s when Louis Lewin, known as the father of modern psychopharmacology, along with his eminent colleague Arthur Hefter, after whom the Hefter Research Institute is named, isolated mescaline from peyote samples they had acquired from the American Southwest. There was active research going on with mescaline through the early part of the 20th century, but then was put aside, and hallucinogen work was really dormant until the great Swiss medicinal chemist Albert Hofmann almost accidentally discovered the profound psychoactivity of lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD, on April 19, 1943, and there's a very famous story associated with that. But Hofmann indeed had discovered a compound that had enormous psychoactivity in minuscule and microgram-level dosages. So this was quite extraordinary. A few years later, Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, for whom Hofmann worked, packaged some of this new compound, sent it to some of the eminent psychiatrists around the world, and suggested they investigate its purported value in understanding the inner world of psychotic individuals. That's where the psychotomimetic model was born. Later in the 50s, psychiatrists found that small dosages loosened defenses of their psychoneurotic patients, making them more open to insight and verbal association in psychoanalytic treatment. But also by the late 50s, early 60s, some investigators like Humphrey Osmond, the Canadian psychiatrist, found that utilizing a very high dose under optimal conditions might induce a profound psycho-spiritual epiphany or some a mystical level experience, which they found was predictive with good outcomes in, for instance, the alcoholic population they were subjecting to treatments. That even one high dose session, if it induces a psycho-spiritual epiphany, was found to have great potential value in helping an individual go down a different and much healthier path of complete sobriety. So there was some wonderful work being done at that time. Later work with Groff at Maryland also found that people who had this mystical level experience were more likely to have positive outcome in regards to lower anxiety, improved mood, even lower pain levels, reduced need for narcotic pain meds. These were terminal cancer patients, and also improved overall quality of life.
Yeah. By the way, I interviewed Groff in 73.
Ah, wow.
When he was not for this radio show, right. but for a video I was making in Massachusetts about the research that at that time was sanctioned by the state of Maryland and the federal government. In looking at your work online and so on, I didn't find any one website to lead people to. Do you have one you recommend?
Well, certainly the Hefter Research Institute, www.hefter.org. It was with Hefter that I developed the psilocybin advanced cancer anxiety research study, and they also provided a good part of the funding. And I think a lot of valuable information is available on the Hefter website.
So it's Hefter, H-E-2-F's, H-E-F-F-T-E-R.org.
That's right. So that would be good. One good site. MAPS.org would be another good site.
That's M-A-P-S.
Right, right. They've also developed some studies, mostly with MDMA. They've done a groundbreaking study in South Carolina with Michael Mithoffer looking at the use of an MDMA treatment model for individuals with chronic refractory post-traumatic stress disorder. And they're publishing very favorable results there.
That was a great background. You, that was exactly what I wanted. And then as we mentioned, Timothy Leary, The Summer of Love, all these things, Richard Nixon and the war on drugs and so on, and it all kind of came together to put a dead stop to Groff. I had contacted him to do a follow-up interview, and the letter came back, no longer at this address, you know, from his Maryland work. Are there, just to set up again, are there safety or toxicity issues with the hallucinogens that are being used in this research?
Well, of course, one has to be first and foremost attentive to safety. And establishing the strongest safety parameters are imperative to conducting this kind of research. And I think there was a great deal to learn from the research efforts of the pioneers in the 60s, including Groff, whose model we've utilized and adapted currently. So I think we need to also distinguish between establishing safe parameters in an approved clinical research study versus what can occur under uncontrolled, chaotic circumstances, particularly when young people are involved in risky drug taking, when they're not attentive to the basic rules of set and setting, when they mix these compounds with other drugs or alcohol. At that point, all bets are off. And, you know, we saw in the 60s that a number, you know, large, not large numbers, but a noticeable percent of, albeit a small percent, but a noticeable number of young people did go off the rails. These were, in all likelihood, very vulnerable young people to begin with who were headed towards significant mental illness. But there was a perception, at least, that these compounds sometimes did propel individuals at a greater rate down into a very pathologic place. So I think, though, when we're looking at modern research, you know, that have gone through a number of hurdles to get approved, that establishing the tightest safety parameters are absolutely integral to carrying out these kinds of studies.
Very good. And one other question, which is, since these – this is, again, just about how you study it – since these substances can have such profound effects, even in small doses, how do you conduct a double-blind placebo study? And for some people, they may need to know exactly
right,
what that
means. Well, a double-blind placebo-controlled study essentially means that in this case, we didn't want to deprive any of our advanced cancer patients from having this experience. Many of them had limited time. They were had become enthusiastic when they heard about our research study. We didn't want to have them in a placebo-only and that's it kind of group. So everyone was their own control. Individuals randomized into either receiving the active drug or the placebo first, and then several weeks later they came back and had the other. Both the subjects and myself and my research coordinator, we were all blind to what they had on each occasion, but usually, not always, but usually we were able to discern.
That's what I was thinking.
So, yes.
I mean, like, I believe I read where, in some cases, you would give niacin because it creates
a rush, a flush,
some of the physical things. The physical things may seem the same.
I'm not sure I'd use niacin again. There were some drawbacks with niacin. Nevertheless, niacin was a non-psychoactive compound, which might give the impression of inducing some kind of global effect, but in reality, its psychoactivity is quite minimal.
So you've done how many studies now yourself, Charles Grobe, with psychedelics?
With psychedelics? Well, we did the first phase one MDMA study with normal adult volunteers back in the early 90s. We went to Brazil, to Manaus in the early 2000s, conducted a study with adult members of the ayahuasca religion Unidade Vegetal. We went back to Brazil to conduct another study at the request of the Brazilian judiciary in the early 2000s, looking at the effects of ayahuasca on adolescents whose parents belonged to the Unidade Vegetal, and the adolescents were invited to participate in ritual ceremony. So we worked these young people up to make sure there were no harmful effects, and there were not, from their participation in religious ceremonies with their parents, where ayahuasca was used as a psychoactive sacrament. And then starting around 2004-2005, we initiated our study using psilocybin to treat adults with advanced cancer who had very severe anxiety, specifically existential anxiety.
Okay, so we're going to focus on the psilocybin with late-stage cancer. But first, for those who don't know what ayahuasca religion that you mentioned, give just a little bit of background.
Yeah, ayahuasca is a plant hallucinogen decoction of two separate plants which grow in the Amazon rainforest. If you orally ingest each plant by itself, nothing happens. But when you brew the two plants together for a many, many hour, very elaborate process that the native Indians had developed, you get this profound hallucinogenic compound. The two plants are Banisteriopsis copi, which contains harmine, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmine, and Psychotria viridis, which contains dimethyltryptamine, a very potent hallucinogen, but inactive orally. But the Harmala alkaloids can deactivate the inactivating enzyme system in the gut, allowing the DMT to be absorbed and to activate the central nervous system.
And let me just cut in, because one of the things I've always found remarkable about this is, so you have indigenous people living in a rainforest with vines and plants and everything, and somehow they found
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Over millennia. I mean, you know, a reductionistic scientist like myself would say, well, over many, many centuries, they got around to testing out each combination of plants that grew in that particular area. But if you ask the people who live down there, they'll tell you that it was some form of divine intervention. So there you have it. But for millennia, the indigenous people used it. It was forced to go deeply underground when the Spanish and Portuguese conquered the Amazon region. It emerged again in the late 19th century and 20th century as a mestizo healing in various countries in the Amazon basin like Peru and Ecuador. And then in the mid 20th century, there was the rise of the syncretic churches in Brazil, which utilize ayahuasca as a psychoactive sacrament within their ceremony. Ayahuasca is only taken within ceremonial practice, never taken outside. The people within the UDV, the church we studied, maintain complete sobriety for any other psychoactive compound, including alcohol. They have a strong proscription against the use of cannabis. So, and then in the late 80s, they were investigated along with the other major church, the Santo Daime, which has a slightly longer history. They were investigated by a panel convened by the Federal Narcotics Commission and found that by and large it was seemed to be a very safe process. It was a salutary process. Individuals who belonged to this church appeared by testimony to have benefited enormously in regards to their psychological health and even their psycho-spiritual health. So in 87, it was legalized in Brazil when used within religious structures. Now, as a spinoff to that, in the late the churches established themselves to a slight degree in the United States. There were several UDV temples in the 90s in the western part of the U.S. And in 99, there was a bust by Customs and DEA. The tea was confiscated. Charges were not filed, but the UDV, believing that its freedom of religion rights had been violated, filed suit against the Justice Department. So it went to federal court. I was an expert medical witness, so got to sit in on much of the proceedings. And it was heard by a very conservative federal judge in New Mexico. The headquarters was in Santa Fe. And it lasted several weeks. And to my surprise, the judge ruled on behalf of the UDV that their freedom of religion rights were being violated. And he recommended that their rights be protected. They continue their ceremonies. That decision was appealed by the Justice Department. It went to the Federal Court of Appeals in Denver, where it was first heard by a panel, which ruled 8-5 in favor of a small panel ruled, I think, 2-1 in favor of the UDV was appealed to the full appeals court. It won again. The Justice Department again filed that, objecting to that ruling. So it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 2006 ruled that the UDV was protected by law to engage in their religious ceremonies, including the use of ayahuasca, a very powerful hallucinogenic psychoactive sacrament, that they be allowed to administer it to their practitioners.
That's the voice, by the way, of Charles Grobe, M.D. He's the director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor-UCLA Medical Center, and we're talking about the reemergence of the scientific study of the therapeutic benefits of psychedelic substances. You can learn more at hefter.org. That's H-E-F-F, F as in Frank, H-E-F-F-T-E-R.org. One of the things, I have visited the rainforest and visited shaman there and so on and spoke to indigenous tribes who said, if they take ayahuasca, they weren't necessarily talking about within the church. This was a more primitive tribe than that, but they take it very few times during their life. Right. It is a sacrament of great to which they give great respect.
Oh, absolutely. Only under very specific circumstances will they take it, often relating to healing. If there's a medical illness or a psychological illness, if a crisis has occurred, very often the ayahuascaero or the medicine man within the tribal group will facilitate a session, sometimes a group session, to help facilitate healing for the individual in question.
Okay. So now let's go to the study that you did on, I think it was psilocybin to treat anxiety in late-stage cancer patients. How many subjects? And what were the results?
Right. We had approval to treat 12 subjects, all with advanced cancer, all with serious levels of anxiety. Given that they to get in the study, they all already had to have advanced cancer. 11 of our 12 subjects have passed away by now. But we did find in doing follow-ups that went up to 6 months from the treatment that there were significant reductions in anxiety and improvement in mood. And I should also say that subsequent to our starting our study, two other studies have been approved, both on the East Coast. Both have actually been approved to use a slightly higher dose than we were approved, which was very good to see. These two studies are at Johns Hopkins with Roland Griffiths and at NYU with Stephen Ross. They're both they were approved to treat more subjects than we were approved, but we're looking forward to, once they're done treating their approved subjects, we're looking forward to combining our data and submitting for a national grant to conduct a multi-site study to investigate this phenomenon.
In researching for this, Griffiths studied Johns Hopkins. preliminary results, 14 months after participating in a psilocybin study that was published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, 94% of the subjects said it was one of the five most meaningful experiences in their lives, and 39%, that's two out of five, said it was the most meaningful experience.
The Hopkins group has done some great work looking at the effects of psilocybin in normal volunteers, particularly looking on how it impacted their psycho-spiritual awareness, and they had very, very favorable results. And also, very importantly, they were able to establish very favorable safety parameters.
And then Mithoffer, you said, has done MDMA with PTSD. PTSD is obviously something that, whether it's returning soldiers or people who go through violent experiences like in Aurora, Colorado, a couple of days ago, the survivors, PTSD, rape, crime, and so on. PTSD is a very serious thing. What have they found?
Oh, they've found fairly impressive improvements in the psychological status of these individuals following their treatment, that individuals would be less overwhelmed, be less likely to have intrusive thoughts and memories of the traumatic incident, be less likely to interfere in an intrusive manner on their current function, less likely to have very, very frightening nightmares, and these people would report an improved overall quality of life and improved overall function. Very significantly, while their first group of subjects were traumatized in more or less domestic situations, they are now getting ready to treat a group of returning veterans who've been traumatized by their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The research of David Nutt at the Imperial College of London. Could you talk about that? Because he's done a little at looking what's going on in there.
Right, yeah. David Nutt and his young colleague, Robin Carthart-Harris, have done some very interesting work looking at an intravenous psilocybin model and putting individuals in an fMRI, a brain scanner, to determine what's going on in the brain. And they're coming up with some interesting markers, as it were, which correlate with the psilocybin effect and which might very well correlate with what is observed to be an antidepressant effect, even a rapid antidepressant effect. This work is in sync with some recent work on utilizing intravenous ketamine in psychiatric patient populations. Ketamine, a dissociative, hallucinogenic anesthetic, in the last 5-6 years has been used in a number of studies at very mainstream, very prestigious centers, psychiatric research centers, looking at the treatment of individuals with overwhelming, unresponsive depression and observing a very rapid reversal of the depression, which is, I think very interesting, but very surprising to many people as well.
And ketamine, unlike whether we're talking MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, those are long experiences, correct? 4, 5, 6 hours. Ketamine is brief, isn't it?
Ketamine, be a brief, 30, 40 minutes. Yeah. Psilocybin is a 4 to 6 hour experience. LSD would be an 8 to 12 hour experience. Ketamine is 45 minutes, and it's pretty much run its course. So something is going on a very basic cellular level in the brain involving the glutamatergic neurotransmitter system. So there's a lot of excitement with the ketamine model in research quarters that are not necessarily interested in hallucinogens, but they see this as a kind of a reductionistic model that might lead to some new effective very rapid onset treatments for depression. Remember, one of the problems with treating depression is that it's not uncommon for there to be a delay when you administer a conventional antidepressant, a delay before the antidepressant effect starts to manifest. So if the investigators at Mount Sinai, Yale, and NIMH and other places are accurate in their observations that individuals are going through very, very rapid, almost immediate reversals of their mood status, they're clearly onto something of great interest.
I want to go through a couple of things I've jotted down as we went along. Set and setting. At the very early stage, we were making the distinction between how these substances are administered in these studies and how they might be taken recreationally. What do you mean by set and setting?
Yeah, well, this is one of the most important findings that come out of the early generation of research, that if you control set and setting, meaning you control the mental set of the individual. Individuals are properly screened. They're not harboring any major mental illness. I think significantly for this research, you also screen out individuals who have a first-degree relative who've had a psychotic illness. You also need to examine an individual's intention. Why are they doing this experience? If they're doing this for kicks, that could run into a problem. If they're doing this because they have a serious intention, they want to heal, they want to better understand themselves, they need insight into a problem they're having.
And you actually talk, part of the preparation is to deal with them. And to some extent, you actually set it up so that it is most likely,
right,
if you will, that this will be the experience.
Absolutely. So, you optimally prepare people. You optimally prepare their mental set. You describe the experience. You tell them what the terrain is likely to be like. You go over with them what they want to look at, what questions they want to ask. And then the setting is simply where are you going to have the treatment, who will be in the area. Is it a safe setting? You want to make sure it's safe, quiet, there's protection from outside disruption. And this marks really a critical difference between a controlled, approved clinical treatment in a research setting to what may happen in an uncontrolled, chaotic manner out in the world to individuals who are just using drugs more for recreational intent.
Right. And one other point that we didn't make, a critical factor here is you know exactly what they are ingesting.
Oh, yes.
You know the exact
right.
amount.
Right.
You know that where it comes from and so on. And very often the problems that people have outside of these studies in the recreational use is that they're not actually taking what they think they're taking.
Right, exactly. And in a research study, you're assured purity of the compound. Out in the world, for instance, look at the phenomena of ecstasy, which is often assumed to be MDMA, but it is often not MDMA. There's an enormous amount of drug substitution. So individuals who take ecstasy, I mean, it may be MDMA or it may be a variety of other drugs, relatively benign drugs like aspirin or caffeine or maybe Benadryl, but it could be very serious, potentially dangerous drugs like dextromethorphan or paramethoxyamphetamine, which is considered the most powerful amphetamine known and has been responsible for a number of deaths attributed to ecstasy.
Right. Okay, I wanted to make that point. And then you spoke just a little bit about it, but it seems that – I'm going to ask you two questions. One, it seems that the findings are coming fairly uniformly positive. So my first question is, have there been exceptions to that? Have there been studies where there was a significant either no effect or negative effect? And then second, and this would be probably the question we'll end with, Charles Grobe, is what do we think's going on?
Yeah, well, there are not that many studies to begin with. Studies in the U.S. for the most part have had favorable results.
And we're talking at this point in the resurgence,
right,
maybe 100 subjects?
200? Less than 100.
Okay.
A lot of these at the Johns Hopkins
40,
study.
I think there's 44 in that study.
But there has been some work in Europe as well. There's an incredible neuroscience laboratory at the University of Zurich with Franz Wohlleweider. Hefter has actually set up a research lab there, state-of-the-art brain technology, which is providing some great information. There was one study in Switzerland utilizing LSD to treat individuals with advanced cancer anxiety, and they had rather equivocal results. So not clear what was going on there, but there was that one study which didn't get the robust positive response that I think our study and the East Coast studies have achieved.
So the final question,
and
Charles, what's going on?
Well, and what level are we talking about? I mean, in terms of our society or our culture, what's going on is that after a few decades of absolute dormancy, these compounds are now able to be researched in a safe and prospective matter in very qualified research laboratories and clinical research settings. So once again, it's going to be possible now to safely explore the potential value this treatment model might have to individuals and even to society.
What I meant more was, why do these substances seem to have these beneficial effects, especially since we are so used to treating psychological and mental health issues with maintenance, right? You take something every day to deal with your brain chemistry, and yet we're talking about things where experience.
This is very different. What you're talking about is a potential of a profound transformative experience, even one time only. For instance, let's look at the phenomenon of alcoholics who are notorious for being refractory or non-responsive to conventional treatments. A work dating back to Osmond in the 50s, to Groff in the late 60s and early 70s. Hefter is now sponsoring a study that will start shortly at the University of New Mexico using psilocybin to treat chronic alcoholism. Here the model might be that an individual having a profound psycho-spiritual epiphany might actually and may facilitate such transformative change. He comes out of it a different person on a different path, a path dedicated to sobriety and to really conducting oneself in an optimal ethical fashion. These compounds, they're the great mysteries. They're the great mysteries. We really are just scratching the surface of understanding what's going on there. We may never fully understand, but they do appear to hold great promise, great potential. And if we go about this wisely and don't repeat the mistakes of the past, we may actually have an opportunity to fully explore their range of application and their range of value to our society.
Very good. Thank you, Charles Grobe, one of the investigators of the medicinal benefits and therapeutic benefits of psychedelic substances. Keep up the good work. I'll be joined via phone now by James Fadiman. Fadiman did his undergraduate work at Harvard, his graduate work at Stanford, pioneering research with the Harvard Group, the West Coast Research Group in Menlo Park, and with Ken Kesey. He's a former president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and a professor of psychology. He currently teaches at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, which he helped found in 1975, and he is the author of the new book, which we are going to talk about, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. Welcome, James Fadiman.
It is a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to follow that wonderful program with Charlie Grobe.
Yeah, I, as you saw, we went a little long, but it's like, you know, there's so much good stuff going on. As I do with all guests, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So could you briefly talk about your path to the work that you're doing today?
Yeah, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, minding my own business, graduated, was living in Paris, writing an extremely bad novel, and Richard Alpert and Tim Leary were on their way to Copenhagen to do the first first announcement to a psychological convention about psychedelic work. Complications were lovely, and Richard Alpert said, "The greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I'd like to share it with you." So he did, with psilocybin, and that opened my eyes that there was a lot more to the world than Jim Fadiman had ever imagined. I ended up at Stanford and worked with what was called the West Coast Group in Menlo Park with LSD, and they said, "Would you like to know what we're doing?" And I said, "Sure." And my eyes and heart and soul and spirit were opened much wider. And somehow I managed to stay a graduate student, do a dissertation about LSD, and did research until the government shut us down. And now I'm back. I'm doing some research. I'm publishing, as you mentioned, some things that are not well known elsewhere. And I am not sponsored by any foundation and have no government grants. So I'm much more interested in the general cultural use of psychedelics outside of the research studies, which Dr. Grobe explained, I thought, just wonderfully.
Very good. And let me just, I will just put out as sort of a preface to the rest of our conversation that two of the early notes In the early pages of the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, I'm going to read the quotes. The information in this book is for educational, historical, and cultural interests only and should not be construed as advocacy for the use or ingestion of LSD or other psychedelics. Given that psychedelics continue to be widely available, this material has been prepared to encourage safe and sacred ways to use psychedelics. Fair enough, James Fadiman?
Yeah, I think just as there's safe sex and we try and prevent heroin addicts from getting AIDS, we also want people, when they are dealing with, as Charlie mentioned, something that 92% of a population thinks is the most important experience of their life, I think it should be done as well as possible if you're going to do it.
Okay, and part of what you do in this book, which was interesting to me, I must say, when I picked it up at first, I saw the first three words, the psychedelic explorers. And it wasn't until I picked up the second time that I saw the word guide. Okay?
Yep.
That you really have laid out both sort of an architecture of how an experience might take place, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, really this is not a sensational book by any means, but a guidebook. And what I'd like to do is break that subtitle down, okay?
Absolutely.
We've got four keywords. They're safe, therapeutic, and sacred journeys. First of all, why journeys?
Because the word voyage, which is another nice word, and the word is used by anthropologists for what shamans do, and the word trip has been used up by generations of trippers. And let me preface this by pointing out that you mentioned, with Charlie, how many people were in the national studies, and it's under 200. The figure that I work with is from the federal government that says since LSD became illegal, 23 million Americans have taken it. So that's the group that I'm concerned about.
And I believe you say, what's that number that you say each year will ingest it for the first time? Is it 6,000 or is it
600,000.
600,000, I'm sorry.
So
over half a million.
I've got another year of data and the figure is exactly on.
Okay, so over half a million people each year have their first LSD or psychedelic experience.
Exactly.
Okay. So journey you chose because of, but what I was also getting at there is that it is something which is not a momentary, but it is a journey in that with LSD at least, you've got a time of 6, 8, 10, 12 hours and you start one place, you end somewhere else, and as we say, it's not about the end, it's also very much about the journey.
Very much so, and that since we're dealing with something which is 8 to 12 hours, and there are substances in use which go as long as 36 to 48 hours, it's very important to not necessarily know what you're doing if you're taking it, but to have someone with you who does know what to do, especially if something goes wrong. And something actually does not go wrong very often. But I'm kind of a right-wing fanatic about how valuable having what I call a guide or a support or somebody. I think with drinking, we talk about a designated driver.
Yeah.
And that's someone who not only knows how to drive, but is not in an altered state. And
right.
So we're asking the same thing here, basically not only for people's protection, which is safe, but so that they can use this substance pretty much along the lines that it has been used for thousands of years. Again, Charlie has a wonderful phrase, which is a psycho-spiritual epiphany, which is kind of nicer than the term I would use, just transcendent unity of consciousness. But we're talking the same thing, which is why do people have these massive life changes, as Charlie said, like after alcoholics, from one ingestion of literally millionths of a gram of a chemical.
Yeah, which was my final question to him, and I will get back to you on that one. So journey, we've said why it's that, and then, of course, when you go on a journey, especially to an unfamiliar place, Right. It's good to have a guide. And as you say, a guide, not necessarily a buddy who's taken it and is taking it with you. Not that, but someone who knows the territory and is not in an altered state of consciousness. Someone who is there as, in some sense, your rock, but also in some sense, your fluid, someone who is going to move fluidly with you through your experience.
Well, if you think of a safari guide.
Yeah.
The safari guide really knows the territory, has been there lots of times, and doesn't interfere with your experience. But the safari guide might say, you know, this is your experience, you've paid for this safari, but if I were you, this rhinoceros is coming toward us, I would stand behind this tree. And that's an invaluable moment. And then your own experience continues.
Exactly. Okay, so now let's go to the other three words. How do you promote safety?
Well, psychedelics, in the research that has been done, again, this is more in the 60s, they looked at all the studies that were done by people that knew what they were doing and people who didn't, and there's actually very few people that get in trouble. But there are people who get in trouble, and as Charlie pointed out, part of it is who should not be taking it, and that's people who are mentally unstable. And who should not be taking it is people who don't have any idea that they're being given it. There's a terrible crime that goes out in the young population. It's called dosing someone, which is basically giving them this incredibly powerful chemical without their knowledge. And that almost always leads to trouble.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. So safety is the person and the guide establishing that they're in a state and that they are a subject that this makes sense for. And then the thing that Charlie was talking about when they're doing it therapeutically in their studies, they really talk about what are your goals, what issues are you thinking of dealing with. Would, in your ideal situation, a guide do that as well?
Absolutely. And in the book, there's a couple of chapters on how to be a good guide and also how to be a good subject. And a guide is someone who basically goes over in great detail who you are and why you want this and is this appropriate and what are your questions that you want answered about yourself. Are you doing this for healing? Are you doing this for kind of personal growth where you're not ill but you'd like to be better? Or are you doing this for psycho-spiritual reasons? Again, as Charlie said, if you're just doing it for kicks, that may not be the best way to do it.
Yeah. Okay, so that's safety. Then therapeutic. It's interesting that you who are not dealing with the sanctioned scientific studies, still a therapeutic experience is one of the goals of what you're talking about. How do you promote that it be therapeutic?
Well, partly my background is that I did therapeutic psychedelic research for a number of years until the government said that there was no value to what we were doing. So I know that it can be and has been therapeutic. And so what happens when you have these substances, it's an opportunity for people, if they wish, to deal with ongoing psychological issues, neurotic patterns, and worse. Again, that's a particular use and that needs a guide trained in that use. Again, it's the safari notion. You don't just hand someone, say, a power tool or a weapon and say, figure out how to use it. If you're working with your mind in particular, you want someone who is going to be comfortable if you have to go into difficult parts of your own experience.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm talking with James Fadiman about his new book, Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And you can learn more at jamesfadiman.com. And Fadiman is Fadiman. Finally, sacred. How do you promote a sacred experience?
Well, what I've found, and I've been talking primarily to college-age students, is most of them consider that is one of the major uses, especially when they are taking these substances in an outdoor and usually beautiful setting, that they have the feeling of being much more connected to the natural world, in fact, being embedded in it, in fact, being it, turns out to be very similar to what we describe as classical mystical experience. So for the first time, we have a tool which allows us to directly look at what has been looked upon as kind of very strange and very rare mystical experience, often achieved only after, 15 or 20 years of spiritual practice. So we're dealing with a very powerful tool with very different possibilities. And again, like any powerful tool, knowing how to use it and knowing how to use it well is the best safety. And also, of course, knowing when not to use it. A lot of people ask me, should I take LSD or one of the other psychedelics? And I wait, and they say, I have a few concerns. And then I say, fine, don't take it. That's ideal. And I say, but I haven't told you my concerns. I said, any reason you find where it's not a good idea to do it, listen to yourself. That's the first level of safety.
Very good. Very good. I also noticed that Albert Hofmann, the person who first discovered the psychoactive effect of LSD, when people asked him, he said, always take it in nature. Now, obviously, in both what Dr. Grobe was talking about and what you talk about, often you're not in nature. Often you're in a very comfortable place where one can lie down, perhaps listen to music, feel safe, feel secure, have the weather not be unpredictable, have the external inputs not be unpredictable. But do you also have people in nature as well?
Well, the people that I worked with were all people who were in a safe setting with headphones and a couch and security. But we had in the room flowers and picture books of beautiful nature. And often people, when they would come down after the 8 to 12 hours, preferred to spend time in nature.
Mm-hmm.
That's one half of it. The other is, I really can't stop the 600,000 from doing whatever they're going to do. And so by making a generalization like, take it in a beautiful place with someone who knows what they're doing, I'm sending as clear a message as possible how to maximize benefit and minimize harm.
Yeah. In other words, if you had to, as Hofmann did, if you put it in very few words, it still says not necessarily in an urban, chaotic, unpredictable situation, no matter how much your buddies might be there. You want nature or the sort of safety and tranquility that nature might offer.
Well, the nice thing is when people are lying down with headphones, you have the opportunity to use music.
Yes.
And music, both from all the indigenous people and from independently what we found in the 60s, is music is a way of maximizing the safety internally and the pleasure.
Okay.
Because one has enhanced sensory awareness at every sense. And so music is particularly valuable because it allows people simply to have an experience rather than to think about things.
Very good.
It turns out that this is the way one makes progress with this kind of material in oneself, is to be able to not be too interested in one's psychology, but to be very interested in allowing one's mind to function where it seems to do very well on its own.
And music helps that case. And as you point out, that is also true of the indigenous. It's not just something we came up with when we invented earphones. We're going to have to bring this conversation to a close, but I'm glad we could touch on basically the approach. So what you get in the book, A Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys, is reference to a world of experience, years of experience on how to if one is going to do the psychedelic experience safe, therapeutically, and make it sacred. To learn more, go to jamesfadiman.com. That's J-A-M-E-S, obviously, and Fadiman is F-A-D-I-M-A-N.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They are the same website. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about in two or three articles to give you background on it, you can do that at my site. You can sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thank you, James Fadiman, and keep up your good work.